Last time we just sort of overviewed the period of history that we're looking at. I sort of jumped to the end of the period of the Gemara. So just, background in case that part of it wasn't so clear. We know that during the first Beis HaMikdash, first temple period, the Jews are in Israel. That's relatively straightforward. The northern kingdom gets exiled by the Assyrians, right? And they end up being the 10, so to speak, lost tribes. Some debate as to where exactly they ended up. Everybody today seems to think they're a lost tribe. They're in Africa, they're in India, they're in Japan, who knows? The Gemara actually thinks they came back before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. That's another story. But the Babylonians destroy the Beis HaMikdash. The Jews end up in Bavel. From there, some of them get scattered further east. And there are Jewish communities to today that claim that they are where they are and have been there since the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Because we know the Persians conquered the Babylonians. Cyrus, Persian king, allows the Jews to return to build the second Beis HaMikdash, but most Jews don't go back. 42,630 or 360, I always get confused about that number, come back originally under the leadership of someone named Zerubbabel. Then Ezra brings another wave of Jews back for the second Beis HaMikdash, but the vast majority of Jews stay in the Babylonian Empire. That's through the period of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Greeks come into play roughly second century before the Common Era. That's, Hanukkah is somewhere around the year 160 before the Common Era. The Jews are spreading through this area that are controlled by the Greeks. And then, of course, the Romans come along and they absorb the Greeks. And the Jews are throughout the Roman Empire. So when you look at the map that I gave out last time, you see that the Jews have spread around the Mediterranean, not far from the Mediterranean. In other words, they're not moving north, right? There are Jews in what is today Spain, Portugal, Turkey, that area. You're not seeing Jews at that point in, like, Switzerland. That wasn't a thing. There are Jews in North Africa, as we discussed last time, along the southern coast of the Mediterranean. You're not seeing them down in South Africa, that far. We're not going at that stage. And east, you're not seeing Jews in Poland, right? Basically, the limit is that area that is today Iraq, maybe some of Iran. But they're not going further east at that stage either. This is the period when first the Mishnah is concluded, as we said last time, in the beginning to middle of the third century. And then the Gemara is concluded, Talmud Bavli is concluded, in the middle of the sixth century. That could have a little bit of an orientation that, some of the things that I sort of skipped last time. Okay. Last time I didn't have my notes with me. So just to add a couple of things that I now have, from the notes, I had mentioned last time, that there was a second century headstone with Hebrew in it and I couldn't remember where it was. That was in Spain. So you know that Jews have already reached Spain at that stage, right after the second Beis HaMikdash. That was one point. Second point was I mentioned Jews in arriving in Morocco, fleeing from somebody hostile in Spain. So those were the Visigoths who they were fleeing. That was why I couldn't remember. The Visigoths went Christian and became very harsh towards the Jews, and the Jews end up fleeing from there south. Right, if you know your geography of the area of Spain, the Straits of Gibraltar, right? So the Jews go south across that down into Morocco. There are stories of Berber tribes. The Berbers were originally pagan. Eventually, they become Muslim, but the Berbers there were tribes of theirs that actually adopted Judaism in Morocco. So also worth noting.
Were they there before the Italian Jews? So all the Jews that went to Rome, they came after the Roman officials destroyed, and the other Jews in Spain were there earlier.
So there may have been Jews in Rome before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. That's possible. Mm-hmm. But certainly their major population comes from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah.
Because they have their own, their Sephardi, Ashkenazi, mm-hmm. Roman, right?
Yes.
They have their own.
Right. That's something we're going to have to get to. We're not, okay. But it is 100% true that, keep in mind, Italy wasn't Italy, right? Italy was different provinces, and that's until relatively late in the game. So at that stage, it's not like there would be a unified Italian Jewry. There was no reason for there to be. But yes, Italian Jewry is a thing before Ashkenazi Jewry is. Ashkenazi Jewry actually largely forms from Jews who left Italy, but we'll talk about that.
Okay.
They were their own thing. But that was just a little bit of a recap and orientation of where we are. Now, I had wanted to launch into the period of the Gaonim and go in order in terms of the Gaonim and all of that, but then I realized that there is a tshuva, a letter written by Rav Hai Gaon, who's actually the last of the major Gaonim, that is very Rosh Hashanah appropriate. So I wanted to sort of leapfrog history in order to get to that, because I think it's a beautiful tshuva to learn before Rosh Hashanah. So what I want to do is give a little bit of an introduction to the Gaonim, just so we know something of what we're talking about, and then jump to Rav Hai Gaon, and then after that we can come back to all the other Gaonim. That's okay. Mm-hmm. All right? Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a lot to talk about, but I think we can do it. So last time we talked about the Savo Ra'im, right? We read that piece from Rav Shira Gaon where he gave a little bit of the history. The Savo Ra'im being the Chachamim after the time of the Gemara, who review the Gemara, edit to a certain extent, and there are pieces Rav Shira Gaon said that are in the Gemara today that actually the Savo Ra'im wrote, but they give way to the Gaonim. And I want to talk about two leadership figures. There's what's called the Reish Galusa, and there's the Gaon. Reish Galusa is an Aramaic term, meaning
head of the Galus.
Exactly. Reish, Rosh, head. Galusa is just the Aramaic version of the Galus, the exile. Reish Galusa was a political position. Gaon was a religious position. And they existed side by side. Starting in the middle of, well, let me not start there. That's not a good place to start. That's a mistake in my notes. I shouldn't do that. Okay. Going back to the time of the Gemara, that's a better place to start. The Jews in Babel developed a kind of semi-autonomous self-government. You had a bureaucracy of officials who were led by the Reish Galusa, and that's a position we already find in the Gemara. And the job of the Reish Galusa was, you know, from a Roman perspective or a Babylonian or Persian perspective, was to represent the Jews before the king and to make sure the Jews are paying their taxes. That's more or less the responsibility. And you would see this later on in Jewish history. Jewish communities in various places would have some degree of autonomy. They could run their own affairs. They could even run courts in certain cases, as long as they kept the government happy by making sure that the government got the money that it wanted. That was the agreement there.
Were they the only ones, or there were others that were like that? Like
when you say
other
that.
Sects or other...
Oh, were the Jews the only ones who had this?
Yeah.
I imagine not. Yeah.
Were they like rabbis?
So that's where we're going. That's where we're going with this. That's a great question. The authority of the Reish Galusa didn't only come about because the government liked them and felt them to be useful. The Reish Galusa would claim descent from David HaMelech. So they would be from this line that's going to produce Mashiach. They actually held inaugurations with, you know, like pomp, you know, like as though you're crowning a king. As if to say to Christians around them, the Muslims eventually around them, you know, this is our leader. This is, you know, our version of it, even though they were still subsidiary to whoever was in charge. Obviously, the early days of the Reish Galusa, there are no Muslims around. The Muslims are 7th century. But at that point, it was whoever they were dealing with. From the beginning of the period of the Reish Galusa in the times of the Gemara, the Reish Galusa had ties with the halachic leadership, but things weren't always so smooth. The Reish Galusa was not necessarily a Talmud Chacham. There were clashes, yes. There was one person who was the Reish Galusa.
I see.
So if you take a look on your sheet, I brought you two examples of sort of the relationship between Chazal and the Reish Galusa. So the Reish Galusa lived usually close to wherever the political power was in the secular empire that the Jews were under. So that was actually was going to be my first note, and then I realized it made sense later. Initially, would have been in the area of sort of Sura Pumbedisa, the yeshivos, but when in the 8th century the Muslim leadership was sent, or the caliph was in Baghdad, then they moved to be in Baghdad.
Who appointed them? What did you say? Was it a vote?
So the government, it seems, would be the one to recognize the Reish Galusa, and presumably succession would be linear. You know, you're the son of the previous Reish Galusa, you're the Reish Galusa.
Kind of like a chief rabbi of the
community. It was a political position. It wasn't rabbinic.
Religious, right?
Yeah. It was more of a governor, I would think. But take a look at source number one. And I skipped the meat of the story in order to give the part that's relevant for us. And I'll just read out my English translation. But you have the original there as well. The exilarch had a shady area in his orchard. This is some exilarch. We don't know his name. The Gemara doesn't really give us the names of the Reish Galusa. It's just the Reish Galusa. So he said to Rav Huna Bar Chinina, one of the major Amoraim, do me a favor, please. Le'avad Martakanta, fix this area up so that we can eat bread there tomorrow in this shady area on Shabbos. It's an Eruv issue, right? I have this area. The area is halachically called a karmelis. It's an area that's not a big public domain, but on the other hand, it's not fenced in, and it's not identified as a rishus hayachad, a private domain. So he says, you know, Rabbi, fix this up for me so I can, have bread out in my yard on Shabbos. I'd like to have lunch there. So Rav Huna Bar Chinina comes up with a way. He sets up reeds, you know, as like a reed wall around it, with less than 3 tefach between the reeds, and therefore that works as a wall. You don't need a solid wall. You just need to have gaps that are smaller than 3 tefach. So that's his way of dealing with it. Rava felt that didn't work. Even though you'd say, well, it's a wall, there actually are halachos, and I'm not getting into all the laws of Erev right now, but an area that you're going to be enclosing on Shabbos, in order for it to be called a Rishus Hayachad, a private domain, needs to be enclosed for the sake of living in that area. That's one issue that comes up. So, for example, if you have an Erev that includes a body of water, and people are not able to swim and boat and fish in that body of water, then that actually can disqualify the Eruv. It's one of the major complications that come up in building Eruvin. So Rava felt, for whatever reason, which we're not going to go through right now, it's relevant in the Sugya and the Gemara and Eruvin, that this was actually wrong. Rav Huna Bar Chinina was incorrect. And Rava comes along and he pulls out the reeds. This is a mistake. Then along come Rav Papa and Rav Huna Bredu of Yoshua, and they say, not only is this wrong, but you know what's going to happen. You pulled out the reeds, he's just going to put them back. So they steal the reeds, and they take away the reeds. And then there's this whole thing back and forth in the Gemara about what was wrong and why wasn't it okay and whatever. And the Reish Galusa is so fed up, he quotes you a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, Chachamim Hemela Hara Ulehitiv Lo Yada'u. They're Chachamim about causing harm. They know how to ruin things. They don't know how to make it better. They mess things up for me. So this is kind of, you know, a Reish Galusa who, yes, is a little resentful. That's the image that comes out. But on the other end, he's loyal to Halacha. Like, he came to the rabbi and said, Rabbi, help me out here. I want to be able to eat outside. I'm not just going to do it. I want your help. A little more hostility shows up in the Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 2. The Gemara there is talking about the idea that in order for a judge on a Beis Din to be protected such that in the event that he makes a mistake, he's not liable for his errors, right? Protected essentially for judicial malpractice, at least to a certain stage, he has to get permission from the authorities to judge. If he gets his authority from the Reish Galusa, then he's allowed to judge cases, and it's clear that the mistakes were accidental and not, you know, a function of negligence or ill will, then he's indemnified. He's protected from any liability. When Rabba Bar Rav Huna had some kind of strife with the Reish Galusa, he said to him, I didn't get authority from you. You're to be a Dayan. Yeah, basically. My authority comes from my father, And he got it from Rav, who got it from Rabbi Chia, who got it from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. I don't need you, Reish Galusa. That was essentially what he said. You know, it just, I bring it in order to show, and there's lots of cases that I could bring you, that things weren't always so smooth between the Reish Galusa and the halachic authorities, and that would continue into the period of the Gaonim. Yeah.
Where is this? I forgot what you said.
So they're based in Iraq, starting in the latter half of the 8th century. They'll be based in Baghdad. But they would be near the yeshivas, basically. That's where the major Jewish communities were. So last week we mentioned some places, Sura, Pumbedisa, Masa Machsia, places like that would have been where the Reish Galusa would have been found. Major Jewish communities, which tended to be near the political power of whoever was running the show at that point.
So this was the only show in town?
Yeah.
Or
politically, this is it. This
nothing
is the power.
In Jerusalem, nothing.
So at this stage, no, there's no political authority based in Yerushalayim for Jews at this point.
It's Palestine, right?
So the Romans would have been calling it Palestine, I think, at this stage. I think that's correct. Yeah.
It's nice that they all agree on one person.
I mean, they didn't exactly have another option. Like, if you didn't like it, you still had to pay your taxes through the Reish Galusa. You pay taxes for the infrastructure within the Jewish community, and then you were paying taxes to whoever the greater, you know, empire was in whom you were living. Jews were not autonomous.
No, I know, but so the Reish Galusa had his own taxes then?
Yes, because you needed to pay for the system.
Government.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is in Babel.
Yeah.
Did the Jewry in Spain...
I keep hesitating to call it Babel, because the Babylonian Empire that destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash is long gone by this time.
So what is it?
Babylon? The Babylonians are now Persian-controlled at this stage.
Persian. And in Spain, they are also with the
Any Jews that are in Spain at this point are living under the Visigoths, I believe. Which they didn't have a Reish Galusa. They weren't a large enough community to be identified in that way, to have that kind of political power.
Because the ruler was more in Babylon than in Spain.
Correct. It was a different function. Everything changes with the rise of Islam, because that leads to the creation of a caliphate, which is, spanning a much bigger area and ultimately tries to control Spain as well. Although, we'll get to that. That's not so smooth. But I wanted to get to the Gaon. That was really where... The Reish Galusa is somebody to know about, but the Gaon, as far as we're concerned, is where we want to put our focus.
Well, weren't the greatest Rabbanim or Amoraim first in Spain?
No.
It first was in Babel?
So, the Amoraim were in Babel, yeah. Yeah, there may have been an occasional one who was in Spain, but it was Babel that the Jews were based in, where the yeshivos were that I mentioned last week. Those were all Babel.
And then it moves to Cordova.
No, it never moves to Cordova. The Gemara is never written in Spain. The Gemara is not. No, the yeshivos are in Babel. Yeah.
When is Christianity?
So Christianity's been around throughout this period. Christianity starts, not really. It's important to know.
Yeah.
So Persian persecution closed the yeshivos. Right? There's a reason why Ravina and Ravashi conclude the Gemara. Like, there's a fear of persecution from outside. There's a fear that Gemara is being forgotten. There are all sorts of reasons why they decide to write down the Gemara that are really beyond the scope of the discussion today. But the Persians close the yeshivos. And they only reopen in the year 589. That's when they reopen. And the head of the yeshiva in this new format is called the Gaon. To do away with a common misconception, the word Gaon does not mean genius. That is the way it's used in modern Hebrew. It is not what the word means.
What does it mean?
The word Gaon, you know the word Gaiva?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Body.
So that's what it means to us, but it's not. The word Gaiva, or Gava, more properly in Hebrew, means power. Not Gavoa, that's a base, but Gava means power. A balgaiva is somebody who says, I've got power, somebody who is arrogant. But, you know, if you're familiar with the piyut Haderes Vamuna, right? Haderes Vamuna, Tzvem and Tzvem Chayolam, that one, right? So we say Hagava Vagdula is for Hashem. Gava just means greatness, power. The Gaon is the person who wields the power as the head of the yeshiva. Because it was the head of the yeshiva, Gaon came to mean colloquially genius, because they must be, you know. But it's not what the word means. It's the person with power is the Gaon. And this began, as I said, in 589, which is the end of the period of the Savoraim. So the yeshivos at that stage are primarily in Bavel, the cities Sura and Pumbedisa, which we've mentioned before. There was a yeshiva in Israel as well. There was also a yeshiva in Kairouan, which is in Tunisia. If when you learned history, they talked about Carthage, right? That's Tunisia. So Kairouan was there, but they didn't really have their own independent authority. They tended to consult the yeshivos in Bavel. The Gaonim were the resource on all things Jewish for communities great and small. Letters were sent to the Gaonim, and the Gaonim would send letters back. We talked about that a little bit last week. The letters could be on sort of minutiae, like someone has a particular question about what to do about X, and they sent the letter to the Gaon and they got a response. Or they could be about major issues of Judaism. I gave you a list in source number 3 of some of the major compositions that affected the way Judaism was communicated, which came from the Gaonim. The reason that they're in 2 columns is not because there's any association, like I'm not pairing them off, it was just because I wanted to fit everything on the page, so that was the way I did it.
Did they not ask their own local rabbi?
So the local rabbi was not a thing. There were chachamim in individual communities. I shouldn't say that it wasn't the thing at all, but all psak that we know of came through the Gaon. We know that there were chachamim just because occasionally you find someone send a letter to the Gaon and the Gaon is like, I can't believe a chacham would ask me this question. Everybody knows this. The Gaonim were kind of harsh. Like they weren't nice, polite, grandfatherly. Like that's not the Gaonim. They got involved in a lot of very serious strife. Like they had a hard job. The Gaonim, as we'll talk about when we talk about, you know, some of them individually. I remember that letter was kind of shocking. So these compositions that I'm talking about, just to give you a little bit of a sense of them, the She'iltos of Rav Achai Gaon is an early halachic work. It's organized by Parsha, interestingly. And it's still quoted in halachic debates today, even though Rav Achai Gaon would have been one of the first Gaonim. You're talking 6th to 7th century. Seder of Amram Gaon, I mentioned last week, is the first Seder. I have no idea, by the way, how much history is too much for people. So I don't want to bore everybody.
That's great.
Yeah, okay. So it's, like I said, it's the first Seder. It's literally when a community sent to Rav Amram Gaon saying, we don't know what davening is supposed to be. And he sends them a Seder, which you can get to this day. It's available now in better editions. For a while, we'll get back to it. Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
He made it up, or it was a tradition that he wrote down?
No, he is collecting what is already known. He brings you the Berkos HaShachar, you know, from the Gemara. He does, at a certain point, say, there is this thing that people do that's incorrect. Like, he'll correct things that he knows that people are doing. But it's, you know, it will look very familiar to us, and it will look familiar to the Gemara before him.
Is this Sfarad and Ashkenazi?
Just as an example, if I remember correctly, the bracha of Hanosen Layayev Koach doesn't show up in Seder of Amram Gaon, because it's not in the Gemara.
Why do they have that?
So we may talk about it when we get to Seder of Amram Gaon. We'll see how much focus we'll do on that. Yeah.
This Sephardi Ashkenazi, this different nesachs.
Much later. Mm-hmm. Sephardim and Ashkenazim are not going to show up for another, few centuries. We'll talk about, we'll talk about that once we get through the Gaonim, God willing. But the Sephardim and Ashkenazim aren't going to be a thing until the 11th, 12th century. We're Seder Rav Amram Gaon is, I believe, 8th century, maybe 9th. So, yeah, you've got centuries to go.
And you're saying it's based on the Gemara? The Gemara says what we should daven like that?
The Gemara has a lot of our davening in it, yeah. Not everything. And some things in our davening post-date Seder Rav Amram Gaon by a good margin. Kabbalah Shabbos wasn't a thing. That didn't exist. If you had shown it to Rav Amram Gaon, he would say, what are you doing? Like, I don't know what you're doing. That's
the
spot.
People daven that? There was Minyan people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, davening is around in the second Beis HaMikdash. Davening is not in the first Beis HaMikdash, let's be clear. Aside from the fact that the Gemara tells us Shmona Esrei, is based on the Avos davening at particular times of day, and it's parallel to the Korbanos, and so on. In the Beis HaMikdash itself, you have tefillah. I gave a series once, not for an Orthodox crowd, but it was a broader, kind of community thing called From Bulls to Books. Like how we went from Korbanos to Sidurim. And one of the first things that I tried to stress is there is a sense in just people's general conception of things that sort of we had Korbanos and then we didn't have Korbanos anymore, then we started to daven. That is absolutely not true. Aside from the fact that you find people davening in Chumash, but like when Daniel is in exile in Babel, right? The book of Daniel, Sefer Daniel says, he went to daven by his window facing Yerushalayim 3 times a day, the way that he always did. It's when they made this decree that if you want something, you have to go to Darius the king instead of appealing to anybody else. And it says, Daniel went and he davened by his window the way that he always did 3 times a day, and therefore they saw him davening, and therefore he got in trouble, and he gets thrown into the lion's den, and so on. Yeah, Jews were already doing that. The Gemara talks about the Ma'amados. Every week there's a shift of Kohanim who work in the Beis HaMikdash, and there's a shift of Levim who work in the Beis HaMikdash, and that goes all the way back to the Mishkan's time. And so all the rest of us, not Kohanim, not Levim, had also shifts in different communities who would get together and had a special davening so that there would be representatives of the non-Kohanim, non-Levim, so to speak, for that week, and for the korbanos that are being brought. So every community, you had people who would have a certain special Torah reading they did. Like, tefillah was, absolutely organized and run going back to those times. It's true that with the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, certain things now have to be supplemented. But the practice of davening was absolutely a thing. Yeah. What minyan was and how important it was is a very interesting question in its own right. Because on the one hand, this is the way to daven. And you find in the Gemara that like an Amora misses minyan and everybody's like, hey, where were you? On the other hand, you find stories in the Gemara that today are like unthinkable. Like one of the Chachamim in the Gemara's time, I think it was Levi, is traveling. And I'm trying to remember the story now, but he's traveling like he's out of town and out of a community on Yom Kippur. And like today, it's like, well, why was he traveling? Like, who would do that? You find the Chachamim, like the major Chachamim, the major Tanoim, they're on a boat on Erev Pesach.
The travels are very long in those days, so they couldn't have traveled for a month.
I mean, they're traveling on a boat in Israel. They're probably coming from Rome. It wouldn't have been like a month's long journey.
They're delayed.
They're in the Mediterranean. They're not in the ocean. Sorry?
They're delayed.
They're delayed. Maybe they were delayed. It's just like I would really make sure that I wasn't on a boat on Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, seriously?
Oh, what, like flying on a Friday.
What am I doing on a boat?
That was the four Rabbanim that went to Rome.
So I think you may be thinking of a different trip. Yeah.
Did you do a shiur on Minyan when Minyan started?
Not on when it started, but on Minyan priorities and how they weigh in versus other things. Yeah. So you have the letter that we read from last week, Igeres Rav Shri Ragon, which gives the history of Torah and how everything evolved and how we ended up with machlokos and things like that. The Baal Halachos Gedolos is attributed to different Gaonim, but it's one of the earliest, if not the earliest, collection of just halacha. Like we think of Shulchan Aruch and all of that, like that's the very first one. Ha'amunot v'hadayot, or Amunos v'dayos, Rav Sadia Gaon's attempt to provide a systematic explanation of Jewish philosophy. So that's Gaonim. Agron. The Agron was the first Hebrew dictionary, also Rav Sadia Gaon. And there's a ton of responsa, which we didn't have access to for a long time. Yeah, that's the street, Agron.
Yeah, I'm like looking at it, I'm like, why do I know this?
Yeah, that's because Ramban becomes Agron when it crosses King George. Right. So
what was he?
Rav Sadia Gaon's Hebrew dictionary. That's the very first Hebrew dictionary, is the Agron. We also have, I mean, it wasn't Hebrew English. It was Hebrew Arabic. But also this responsa, for a long time we didn't have access to a lot of it, but it showed up in the Cairo Geniza. And that through that we have volumes and volumes of their chuvos, of their responsa. The period of the Gaonim ends in the 11th century with Rav Hai Gaon. That's pretty much when it ends, and then the Rishonim start in. There was a lot of tension between the Gaon and the Reish Galusa. It was not like smooth working relationship. You take care of the politics and the taxes and I take care of the religion. Like that didn't go so well. The Gaon tended to be more popular and have greater sway over the population, which isn't surprising because you have to pay the Reish Galusa. The Gaon just represents Torah. There were some very notable controversies. Rav Sadia Gaon got in trouble in his day because he would not approve a will. I think it was a will. It was some financial document. I think it was a will on behalf of the Reish Galusa in his day, and the Reish Galusa tried to exile Rav Sadia Gaon, and that didn't go well. We'll talk about that, I expect. One other force to know about at this time, and this is a force from the outside. These are the Karaites. So the Karaites have one version of their history. We have a different version of their history. The Karaite version of their history is that there were always sects of Jews. We know that in the second Beis HaMikdash period, there was a sect called the Tzedukim, the Sadducees. And they believed that the rabbis don't have an accurate tradition of how to explain the written Torah. And the Karaite view is that the Sadducees actually were more popular than the rabbis, but somehow they ended up shrinking, and we are their descendants. The Karaites claim to be descendants of the Sadducees, because the Karaites themselves argued also against rabbinic explanation of biblical text. The traditional version of the story was very different. There was a fellow by the name of Anan ben Meir, who led a sect. This would have been, I think, 9th century, and he got in trouble with the Muslims because the Muslim authorities did not want sects, not from Islam and not from any of the religions underneath them. Like, you had to be part of a recognized religion. And so they were actually going to execute him as a heretic. He was imprisoned, and he met someone in the prison who gave him an idea. The idea was, tell them you're not a sect. You're the authentic Jew. What you're teaching is authentic Judaism. It's these other people who are the sect. And so that's what he did. That was the traditional explanation of how Karaism came to be. It was a claim of, we are actually authentic Jews. Our Judaism is the one. Karaism, whichever view you take about where they came from, was influenced by Islam. They used Muslim methods of interpreting verses from the Torah. I should have started actually with an explanation of the word Karaism itself, or Karaut. It comes from the word Kuf Resh Aleph. It means, to read or text. Right, Kra itself means text. So they're not just in the text. They're not just in the text. This is what people always say about them. It's not quite accurate. They did believe in interpreting it, But they took Muslim methods that they were used in the Quran, they took for interpreting Torah. They believed in a very limited human role in interpreting law. They embraced Jewish practices which had Muslim parallels, like washing before davening. They loved that because, you know, that's found in Islam as well. Bowing during prayer, very into that idea. No, I'm not kidding. They did not believe in Hanukkah or Purim, because they said rabbis created those. Yeah, no fun, seriously. Then they wonder why they're shrinking. They believed that the calendar should be set by observing the moon. Not this whole thing where the rabbis fixed the calendar, the rabbis played with the calendar to avoid Yom Kippur being on Sunday. Yeah. They might have a leap month, the Karaites. I don't know if the Karaites have a leap month, which the Muslims do not. Right, that's why Ramadan ends up being a different month, you know, all the time because of that. Yeah.
So. Were they originally Jews who went off the path, or Muslims?
No, they seem to have been Jews.
The original Jews.
I believe so.
I don't know that movement.
I wouldn't really compare the two, but they were Jews. Yeah. They did not accept a lot of what we have as oral traditions. Example, we say that if milk falls into meat, right, unintentionally, the ratio is small enough, then it can be nullified in the mixture, 1 in 60, right? That's found in the Gemara. It's a tradition of 1 in 60. And the Gemara talks about how we know, this carbon, whatever, not important for right now, but they didn't have that. Like, they didn't believe in traditions like that. That's just the rabbis playing with Judaism. They said the Torah says that you can't have a flame burning on Shabbos. Not that you can't kindle it, but it can't be burning. So no fires from before Shabbos. Correct.
It makes sense, though.
No, but
don't try it.
You have to believe in literal text. Yeah.
They also believe that that Shavuos is always a Sunday. Because the Torah says you can't be macharas ha-Shabbos, the day after Shabbos. So therefore, Sfiras HaOmer starts on a Sunday, and that way your Shavuos is always going to come at the end of the day.
They also believe it has like dairy and meat because it would just be cooking like the goat in the
mother's milk. Yeah.
Do they believe like Ayin Shabbat to kill people?
I don't know. It's a good question. There are Karaites around today, not too many, but they do exist, and you could ask them. There is a group in Israel. I believe there's a group in Chicago. I think there might be a group near Muncie, but I'm not 100% sure of that. I remember hearing that.
It kind of makes sense, like that. It's easy to.
We're trying to avoid Lashon Hara close to Yantif. Thank you. Yes.
Don't you see it as like how the world is today? Like we do the same thing.
What do you mean?
The way they make different ways to be religious.
Oh, the idea of sex is not new. You're 100% right. Okay, so all of this brings me to the tshuva of Rav Haigon, even as I want to make sure that we also have time to do some parsha. So I want to get started at least on it, and then we'll see. Yeah, I know. There's a lot here. Yeah, it's 11:45. Well, that's because we started late. And this says we started 37 minutes ago. Israel 11:43. All right.
I don't know why you're looking at me. I'm here on time always.
Yes, I am not blaming you in the least.
We're gonna take.
Well,
no, but I want to do parsha. Don't say.
Okay.
That
so what we're gonna do? We're losing time, folks.
Okay.
So we're gonna start with this tshuva just so I can explain the issue. Maybe we'll come back to it on the 29th, which is I think we decided we have shiur on the 29th. You think?
Are most people here on the 29th?
It's the Thursday after Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, right? We're there.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so we can do that. So we're going to come back to Rav Haigon later on, but the point is this tshuva, which in some ways seems maybe a response to Karaism. We have a mitzvah of blowing shofar, okay? From the Torah, as the Gemara explains it, the mitzvah of shofar is to blow 9 blasts. That's it. Tekiah, trua, tekiah. 3 times. It's based on the wording that the Torah uses in presenting the mitzvah of shofar. I'm not talking about all the details right now, but that's the core mitzvah. However, we have different versions of what a teruah is, and that's what you see on the sheet in source number 4. A teruah, according to some, is this kind of staccato gasping cry, tu-tu-tu-tu-tu-tu-tu, or it's what we call a shvarim, which is the 3 longer sounds. Two, 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 right? And then, of course, we have another sound that we use, which merges the two, Shvarim and then Teruah. So what we do is we end up using all three versions of what a Teruah is. So we go from 9 blasts to 30. Because what we do is, Tekiah, Teruah, Tekiah, like what you see in the heading in number 4, Tekiah, Teruah, Tekiah, Tekiah, Teruah, Tekiah, Tekiah, Teruah, Tekiah, we do that with one kind, and with the second kind, and with the third kind. So you end up with 30, because Shvarim Teruah counts as 2. So it's 9 plus 9, right? That brings you to 18, plus 12, that brings you to 30. We also do that once in the beginning of shofar blowing, before Musaf, and then we do it again as part of the Musaf Shemona Esrei. So we end a number another 30 there, and then after Shemona Esrei, for good measure, we throw in another 40, which is its own discussion, not for right now. But the point is that they're doing 30 blasts. How they get to that, I brought you the Gemara in source number 5, which explains what happened. Rabbi Avahu was the one who instituted going over to the 30 blasts. He says, we're going to do Tekiah, what we think of as Tekiah Shvarim, we're going to do Tekiah Teruah, and we're also going to do Tekiah Shvarim Teruah Tekiah. And he goes through that Gemara, which I translated for you in source number 5, but we're not going to do inside right now because of time. He explains how it is. That's how it is that we end up with Teruah, Shvarim, and Shvarim Teruah. Flip the page, please, to the table at the top of the next slide. This is, the first table is how we blow shofar during Musaf. I believe this is true for general shuls today. It could be that someone has a different practice, but I think this is generally true. The three brachos in the middle of the Musaf Shemona Esrei are Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros. Okay, those are the three brachos. One speaks of Hashem as King, one speaks of Hashem remembering us, remembering our merit, and one speaks of the mitzvah of shofar, or passages in Tanakh that are about the shofar. So, with Malchios, we blow the shofar with that top line. Tekiah Shvarim Teruah, Tekiah Teruah Tekiah, Tekiah Shvarim Teruah Tekiah. We get all the versions of the Teruah in. Zichronos, same thing. We get all the versions of the Teruah in. Shofros, we get all the versions of the Teruah in there. You follow? Mm-hmm. So each bracha in the middle of the Shmona Esrei is getting a full set of blasts. All the different versions. Got it? Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a community in the time of Rav Haigon in the 10th century which says, we don't understand what we're doing, because they didn't do it that way. They did Malchios, Tekiah Shvarim, 3 times, Zichronos, Tekiah Teruah, 3 times, Shofros, Tekiah Shvarim Teruah, 3 times. And they said to him, we have 2 questions for you, which are in sources 7 and 8, but I'm just going to summarize it. Number one, they said, if Tekiah Shvarim is the right one, let's say the real Teruah is 2, 2, 2, right? Let's say that that's what it is. We're only doing that for the Malchios Bracha. We're not doing it for the Zichronos Bracha. We're not doing it for the Shofros Bracha. That means that we're only doing it right for one of the three Brachos. And if it's really a Teruah, then we're only doing it right for one of the three Brachos. And if it's really Shvarim Teruah, we're doing it right only for one of the three Brachos. We're doing it wrong for 2 out of the 3. We just don't know which 2 out of the 3. They'd be a lot happier if they did it the way we do it, because we blow all the variations for each of the brachos.
Why do they do that?
So that's where we're going. But that's one question that they ask him. Everyone follows this question? Why are we doing this the wrong way if we're 2 out of the 3? That's number one. And number two, a more basic question. We've been blowing shofar every year on Rosh Hashanah from the beginning. How did we forget what a Teruah is? Why doesn't everybody just know it's what we did last year? Like, what happened that Rabbi Avo has to say, well, the Teruah could be this, or could be this, or could be this combination of this and this. Like, why didn't you just know?
Well, when did it start? In the Midbar? No.
I mean, when we got the mitzvah originally. That this should be something that we've been doing literally since the beginning. And if it's not, when did it start? I don't understand. So those are the two questions that they send to Rabbi Avo. They're really good questions, no?
Yeah.
So he gives them an answer. I don't want you to come into Rosh Hashanah, you know, thinking something terrible about Shofar. So I'm going to just tell you what his answer is, but we'll see it inside, you know, eventually. But his answer to them is that you're misunderstanding what Rabbi Avahu did. Trua just means a broken sound. It doesn't have to be Shvarim. It doesn't have to be Trua. It doesn't have to be Shvarim Trua. Any broken sound was valid. Some communities chose to do it this way. Some communities did it that way. Some communities did it. All of those were legitimate explanations of a broken sound. And what he said, and this is his response to the Karaites, really, is Torah is what Jews do. You don't go back to the book. You ask yourself, what is it that Jews are doing? And if you see Jewish communities that are blowing shofar this way, that's the way to blow shofar. We'll talk about that more, because that needs explanation a little bit and unpacking. So I want to come back to that point in a future week. But he says, those were all correct versions of blowing shofar. Rabbi Avo's chiddush was to say, I want to unify the Jewish people. I don't want this community blowing shofar this way, this community blowing shofar that way. That's terrible. So get everybody on the same page, and we'll all blow these blasts. But it's not that one is valid and one is invalid. When you're doing your Tkiah Shvarim three times for Malchios, that's all good. Tkiah Trua for Zichronos, that's all good. Tkiah Shvarim Trua for Shofar, that's all good. That's what Rav Hai Gon explained to them, and it was answers like that that weren't just like a narrow answer to a practical question of, is this kosher? What bracha do I make on this? But a more broad explanation of how Judaism works that Gaonim provided that really steered the way that Torah is today. Clear? Okay, let's talk a little Parsha.